Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of New Books in Japanese Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host today, Jingyi Lee from the University of Arizona. Today we have with us Dr. Imai and Dr. Yusuke to talk about their new book, Creativity in Tokyo, Revitalizing a Mature City, recently published by Palgrave Macmillan. Dr. Imai is currently an associate professor at Senshu University in Japan. She researches and teaches about vernacular landscapes, cultural identities, and urban practices in modern Asia. Dr. Yusuke is currently an associate professor at the University of Ljubljana in Slovenia. His research covers urban sociology, cultural geography, as well as social ecology. In this book, Creativity in Tokyo, the authors explore the changing context of creativity of Tokyo in an age of globalization. More specifically, through a series of interviews with creative actors in local neighborhoods, Dr. Imai and Dr. Yusuke discuss the roles of soft, or they call social factors, in urban creativity. Welcome, Dr. Imai and Dr. Yusuke. Thank you so much for joining us today to talk about your book.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Before we start talking about the book, I'd like to just learn more about you as a person. Could you, I guess the both of you, could you tell us more about how you started your journey as a scholar in urban sociology and cultural identities, and I guess in the case of Dr. Imai, why did you choose Japan to do your researches on?
I might have to go back some years, but I was in Oxford writing my master thesis about gap spaces and spaces and anyway in Tokyo, and I realized during some fieldwork there that there's much more to do about, you know, that spaces people call nichi no seikatsu, the really ordinary spaces. So I went on to prepare a PhD fieldwork, and then, of course, PhD thesis at the university, Metropolitan Manchester University. And during that time, I often came to Tokyo before really living also in Tokyo. And I just stayed on and stayed in Japan, being still fascinated by that gap spaces. So that is actually how I think I came to Japanese studies, also studying more about Japanese urban landscape, and then of course social problems that was added by then. Yeah.
Thank you. That's very interesting. Mm-hmm. And how about you, Dr. Yusuke? What about social ecology and cultural geography that interests you so much to pursue a career in this?
Yes, I had quite a different trait probably from my colleague. Well, my history with Japan probably started when I was already quite young, I would say. I got this, bug for Japan already in the young age. To tell you the truth, I was a passionate for anime and for for Japanese mangas in my early days. So this is how it all started. And then it just transcribed through my study years until I finally got the first scholarship for Japan. And this is where all the story with the research started, and it just grew with the years gradually until we came to this part when I started actively engaging in the research in Japan. So I can say that it started gradually from the very beginning and came up to the today's result, I would say. This would be somehow, let's say, a quick overlook of my relation with Japan and Japanese studies.
That's wonderful, actually. I would be very much embarrassed to admit that I also started my interest in Japan from anime and manga. And after several years of watching those early anime, I find myself in a graduate program in Japanese studies. I guess that's something we all share in common. Now, looking back at your journey, are there any memorable moments or people that influenced your work or your life or your study, your choice of career?
Actually, I mean, you know, being seeing Japan as a country which is quite different where we are both from in Europe. I first came to Japan, I think 2003, and I was at that time studying Japanese language in the Netherlands. I lived, and I moved to Kyoto for 3 months for a language program, and the house I lived in belongs to Venezia Smith, which is a very famous figure in Japan, often known NHK, and the friend who connected us, her husband is a monk. So my very first encounter with Japan was actually an obon ceremony led by her husband. You know, Hiei-san is a very famous, you know, religion or, you know, subdivision of, you know, Buddhism. And that was very impressive because he couldn't speak any English and I couldn't speak at that time very much Japanese. So that was a summer which changed me, and I really wished to come back to do research in Kyoto, which I then did 2 years later with a scholarship. So I guess that was not Tokyo, that was actually, you know, Kansai and Kyoto. And yeah, this deep, combination of tradition and modernity.
Cool. And what about you, Dr. Yusek?
Yeah, in my case, I would say that the trigger factor in this story was Professor Ritsuko Ozaki from Imperial College in London. And she, in fact, put me, let's say, used also her network to put me in the connection with other people in Japan, with other professors in Japan. And I would say that she triggered, in fact, this chain reactions in my liaison with Japan. So this is how it all started. So if I could say that somebody really influenced my starting years in Japan, I would give the credits to her. And so this would be a good starting point, I would say. And then Professor Kazushi Tamano from the Tokyo Metropolitan University. So these two persons really, let's say, put me on the in a good position to start my research, to start exploring, researching in terms of urban sociology in Japan.
That's wonderful. Thank you. Now let's turn to the book. I really enjoyed reading your book, and especially the pictures you included in the book. They are amazing as they capture scenery that I think many people tend to pay very little attention to because they're just so everyday and so common, seemingly. I'm curious how you started this project. How did you first start paying attention to Tokyo's creative ecosystem or notice the significance of these creative elements?
I guess maybe we should go back some years. I think that was 2014 where we met in person. I mean, we haven't been in contact before, so we basically met through some common connections. There was the year when the Rio de Janeiro Olympics happened, and there of course were also events at the embassy in Tokyo, the Brazilian embassy in Tokyo, and I think if I can remember correctly, Dr. Orsic was at the scholarship, anyway, at the exchange, and we sat in a cafe and basically discussed that we have very much in common, and it would be great to do something together, either a paper or a book. At that time, we really thought that would be worthwhile, and after, I think, Dr. Orsic left Tokyo, we basically kept on using Skype and other methods to talk to each other and exchange our ideas, write an abstract with some very important research questions, conduct some research, answer some of the main questions, like how do we define creativity and what is missing? And I think it took quite a while to find this kind of common, common approach and thing. But I think that was, maybe more in his area from the very beginning, but absolutely in my interest to find out more about these creative factors and social factors in Tokyo.
Yeah, and if I may just add to what Heide already explained, and what also you already mentioned before, that some things that we are studying maybe seem common for a Japanese eye, but it's exactly, I think, this position of we are, in fact, if I may say so, we are gaijins in terms of we are outsiders in terms of that we are not Japanese citizens and so on, but it's just exactly this outsideness that also provided a different angle of view, and this is what in fact triggered maybe our interest, because what we saw in the case of Tokyo is that although Tokyo is so unique and although Japan in general is so unique, it is so well globalizing, it is so well using all kinds of global elements and integrating them into their, ecosystem and creative ecosystem, that this ecosystem is gaining qualities of both global worlds and unique local worlds. And this is what triggered our interest in these modification, transformations that are going on in Japan and that are really unique. And being an outsider in this regard, it's not to be considered that you have, a worse angle of view or that you have a diminished point of start. It's quite the opposite. It can also mean that you have a privileged view because you can decipher some global elements that are being integrated benevolently or imbenevolently into the structure of Tokyo, into the structure of the creative ecosystem of Tokyo. So it's exactly standing on the border between two worlds that enabled us to see the story of Tokyo creativity in a little bit special way.
Indeed, I completely agree. Actually, in the beginning of your book, in the very first page of the introduction part, you kind of mentioned this new perspective from a gaijin's angle. I mean, I'm a gaijin myself in Japanese studies, but it kind of stood out to me that you had to almost justify for your perspective in this study, in the introduction part. Just out of curiosity, I'm wondering if you had to explain this part because you met any sort of difficulty or disagreement in your standpoints in doing this study, because to give this question more context, my own studies are in pre-modern history, pre-modern Japanese history, and I very seldom see authors in my discipline or in my field explain their their special perspective in the matters that they research. So have you ever, in your years of researching in Japan, encounter any of questioning or doubt from other people about your own perspectives on Japan?
Go ahead, Heide.
This is very, you know, this is a, you know, broad question, or let's say there could be several things which come to mind. But I had often people commenting on how can you live in Japan and do research about Japan, because they think the more you live here, the more you glorify it. So I think there's this double kind of layer, being a gaijin, living outside, coming as an academic, still you might be not considered to be truly understanding Japan, because Nihonjin Lon is kind of, we are special, so you can still not get the depth if you, starting with the language and so on. But I often had this prejudice, eventually you're losing that objectiveness you need to do research in Japan, or anyway about Japan, about Tokyo. At least that is what I have heard several times, and I don't think so. I absolutely don't think so. I think even more it is good, like we did it, that we had a good exchange about our perspectives on the situations, or, you know, about our research. And I think it never really mattered whether we are in Japan or outside Japan.
I completely agree with what Heidi said. Maybe my experience of this angle of perspective, which is changing with changes with your embeddedness in a specific culture. I had this experience when I was doing for the first time the interviews in Japan, and what I noticed when I was doing these interviews is that this embeddedness in the cultural scene really influences how you value specific things. And when I say value specific things, I really mean these soft and hard factors about which we talk in the book. For example, I was doing interviews regarding the Tsukiji fish marketplace during that period when I was in Japan. And I was, for the first time, in fact, because this was my first encounter with research in Japan, I was a little bit surprised how specific groups of people that I interviewed, because I interviewed quite a versatile, quite a different groups of people, from academics to civil society groups to normal citizens and so on. So it really surprised me how specific groups value Tsukiji fish marketplace in a really different way than a person which would be embedded in a different type of cultural ecosystem would value. So, and this surprised me a lot. And this sparked my interest in the, let's say, in this division of soft and hard factors when it comes to evaluation of non-monetary values in a specific culture. So this, of course, each culture has different angles of how to look at non-monetary values, or these soft factors within a culture. And what surprised me most in the case of Japan is that these soft values are changing. They're changing, and how are they being transformed? So it's difficult to answer in a simple way to your question, because I can say that my view about specific things were all the time challenged. It was all the time a challenge. And when you try to do research, you try to construct out various models, perceptions of thinking, which were, of course, also changing during all these times that we were doing the research. But yes, this differential specifica between gaijin and Japanese perception is tremendously interesting, and how it modifies with the alongside with the duration of alongside the dimension or the variable of time. And this is which is of special in which should be of special interest inside of this story. Because when we started the book, everybody was looking at creative industries in one sense, and then after the book was finished, we may say that we already noticed some changes that are happening, that are materializing also in the case of Japan. So yes, I was. I can say that our views have been all the time challenged, but this is exactly what makes a researcher even more attentive and more interested in the thing, I would say.
That's fascinating. I think a lot of learners and lovers of Japanese culture or other cultures in general will find inspiration in your perspectives. I'd like to move on and to talk about your choice of Tokyo as the stage of this study. So the subtitle of your book is Revitalizing a Mature City. Can you speak more to the nuance of Tokyo as a mature city? You mentioned political and economic elements in the book and efforts by the government and so on. Could you elaborate more on that?
I guess Matthias might be better in that matter. So,
yes, maybe if I start, why maturity? We perceived maturity in two ways. This is why we gave such a subtitle to the book. Because maturity can be, from one angle, it can mean rigidness. It can mean that something is non-movable, that something is really hard to make any change. And this can mean maturity, that you're getting older, that you're getting more solidified. On the second, from the second angle, from another perspective, matureness can mean experience, richness, abundance. This incredible accumulation of knowledge, of your impressions, of perceptions, of it's a really a container of experiences and richnesses that can be used to of course to amplify the creative capacity of Tokyo. So these are the two elements of maturity, or the two dimension of maturity that we try to address. And in fact, in book, we say that we see both of them in Tokyo. So Tokyo is in one sense, because it's so colossal, it's the biggest city in the world. It's in one perspective, it's so difficult to move the system. But at the same time, the system has so much richness. And this is why it makes it fascinatingly unique in the world's terms. Tokyo, it's unique in this perspective. And because it's unique, it's also, I'm going to use this cliché term, that it is a real and a real living lab, if I can say so. And I don't want to say it in a pejorative way of thinking, but it's a living lab of future. And this is why Tokyo is dramatically interesting for the future of the world, because the system, if we look globalization on the whole scale, the world is getting more globalized, and it will undoubtedly become even more globalized. And when we come to the end, when there is no space left, we'll have similar phenomena which are happening already in Japan, and that are already here, and they need to be studied, because we'll come to terms with it. Yeah, we'll have to come to terms with it.
That's very interesting, and I believe the Olympics next year that's happening in Tokyo is certainly a very important aspect in the globalization of Tokyo. as well as its significant role in the global stage.
Maybe just to add two terms which come to mind, there is that it's actually very interesting that Tokyo, or as a mega city or as a biggest city in the world, is maybe not even so much speaking for the whole of Japan. But what it has is that you have this hyper-modern and hyper-local next to each other. And there are so many fascinating, not just subcultural elements, but, elements which you just see if you really immerse yourself in that scene, whether it is Tokyo or Japan as a whole or the Japanese studies as a whole. And if you don't pay attention to that detail, then you just overlook it as, chaotic, very special, very driven by, let's say, Pokemon or others. But it's not, there is always that, fine grain, and as we said, this micro scale, and being constantly going back to that and studying actually what is maturity. And even then, on the top level, they might have realized, global events or mega events might help. But I think on the bottom side, whether Tokyo Olympics happened this year or not, or in what kind of scale, I think people already moved on to say, okay, now we had this memorial year also for, I think, Tokyo 2020, that beforehand tourism was a kind of, tool for everything. But now maturity, people realize we have to find other approaches to address it. And that is now really in the process. So it's very interesting to see what is coming in the next years.
That is very true. I completely agree. One thing I loved about Tokyo when I was visiting there for a few days was that when you're walking on the streets, take a turn, and you immediately, it's as if you completely go into a different place from all the tall skyscrapers. You're suddenly into this quiet alley with sort of old houses. That contrast was one of my favorite things in Tokyo. So I have some follow-up questions here. So early on, you mentioned soft factors, or in the book, you called it socio-environmental factors. And throughout the entire book, it seems to be one of the core concepts that constitutes this study. Could you give some examples of how these soft factors play into the context of urban creativity, and why should we pay so much attention to them?
Okay, I can start with the introduction into soft and hard factors of creativity. So the idea was that usually when we talk about creativity in general, we have focused too much on the output, so on the product. So whenever you see people talking on TV or in media about creative industries, they mention or they show just the most blistering, the most impressive outputs of this type of industry. But the thing is that this is just at the top of the pyramid. And what you don't see on the TV is that this pyramid, you don't see the let's say the 99% of this pyramid. So because you see just the product, and the product to get to the final product, there had to be a chain of events, and this chain of events includes chains of actors which contributed to this end product at the end of the pyramid, and this is the, let's say, the main problem of this process of creative industries. Why? Because you can, for example, start policies. You can, for example, start with very precise political programs, how to work on creative industries or how to work with creativity in a specific city. And during these processes of, trying to produce urban creativity, you often occur, or let's say that political actors often neglect this bottom parts of this pyramid that I was talking about. So they see just the product, and they just try to work on the product and just try to come to the end product immediately. So they try to fast forward the process and just produce the best possible outputs of this process. So it's it is a fast policy. In fact, it is a fast forward policy that tries to have quick effects. But the problem is that on the other hand, not a lot of policies think on the long term, because this long term policies would involve painstaking process which takes a lot of time, a lot of changes in terms of political actors and so on, and because of this they are unpopular, and this brings specific disorders, ambiguities into the city spaces. Why? Because with this introduction of fast policies, this long-term effects of what these fast policies make on the creativity, on urban creativity, are forgotten. So, in other words, by implementing quick-term policies, by implementing, by trying, by concentrating on the output, on the product, we forget about the people which make this product. And not only by people, we mean the very communities, local communities, where everything starts. And these local communities is where these creative actors grow out from. These are the roots of the creativity in each city. So local communities, neighborhoods. And if these neighborhoods, these local communities, don't function well, then you can have creativity for a short term, but not for the long term. And this is what we try to put our focus on. Maybe Heidi can also to do.
I will just add a bit about that soft factor, social economic factor, social environmental factor. Because that creative actors are placed in specific environments, and it is they are shaped by their environments, and they are shaping their neighborhoods and environments. So I think this correlation that we are not just talking about creative class and middle class and how this is growing and how, of course, this also becomes a tool of urban planners and so on. But I think it's much more that kind of dialogue and having traditional craftsmen or residents living there and artisan or artists moving in or being present maybe already or using vacant spaces, and then finding a kind of new coexistence. So it is not always, that top-down perspective which we should look at and say, oh, how can urban planners use it? Because the question is often maybe... Yes, there are famous places like Harajuku or Shimokitazawa where, of course, creative industries play a huge role and are commodified. But even in the smaller sense, it's very ordinary common spaces and people and, micro cultures have maybe found a symbiosis which is working well and which we should look at, study them and find out how maybe a kind of meso level of talking to people what they actually need and how planners can keep such a, human scale. I think this is very important.
Thank you. That is very interesting. And I can definitely imagine how this mode of that this framework can be applied to many other areas in this world where local creativities are being ignored or being overshined by these so-called modernization. So in the latter half of the book, you introduced some case studies to demonstrate their uniqueness of creativity. Could you talk more about these cases as to how they practice creativity and what their significances are in the broader picture of creativity or urban creativity in Tokyo?
maybe, you know, I will start here and then Matthias can, of course, you know, say something about it. I think you very well see that, of course, it starts with kind of framing the case studies. And the case studies are, I don't want to say randomly chosen, but we try to include case studies which are not so prominent, which are not so famous, which are, of course, existing and CoEngine, you can say, is well known. So it's a, I don't want to say, you know, not a logical consequence, but it is a kind of representing the a diversity of cases. So it starts with cases which are, I think, classified in the chapter one, Going Local, where you see Hikifune and Kyojima, which are maybe for the people who don't know, are located in the east of Tokyo, near the Sky Tree, near the new Sky Tree. And actually, it is interesting to see that most people maybe know about the Sky Tree, but not about the surrounding areas. So here you have two neighborhoods which are clearly, I don't want to say overshadowed, but one has tried to implement creative elements it had and also the uniqueness of the area, but developers haven't really followed that proposal. And we see in more and more the rise and the growing of a very generic, I don't want to say bed town, but it looks much like a bed town with unique clothes and all the shops which we might know from other stations around Tokyo, also train stations around Tokyo. And just a bit south of it, maybe not so much accessible because, you know, there is no major train station just in that area. We have a very unique, you know, small-scale neighborhood around the Shotengai, which is, of course, Shotengai Shopping Street, which is, you know, of course, also run down because, you know, people get older and, you know, younger people don't really shop there anymore. So in the end, we see vacant spaces being available and used by artists who obviously have been welcomed. Yeah, so there was never a discussion of fighting over that areas, but actually being happy that people showed some interest. And then we move on a bit into more downtown. I don't want to say downtown, but you know, the central areas around Akihabara. Anyway, the kind of, it's known as the Central East districts, which have already started 20 years ago to realize that these areas are, having more and more vacant spaces because traditional storage and industries have moved out, have moved online, have disappeared. And here we see a lot of storage housing and, other, let's say, business buildings being empty. And actually, several organizations started 15, 20 years ago to realize that we should do something with it. And I think we here have to mention Taitoku, the Taito Ward, as very leading in that organization. They used a school as a new design center, and the approach was very good. They said you can rent or you can, apply for an atelier, kind of studio for 3 years. You need a business plan. And after 3 years, you have to move on to try to be independent. And this is working well since so many years that, of course, it has attracted many people to then stay in the area. And other institutions, including, you know, even some public, private, and even private institutions, I don't want to say copy that concept, but move on to, you know, have add to that scene design centers and, other studios and ateliers. So it's a very unique area, which is, I don't want to say highly popular, but you see the rise of, you know, rent prices and even, you know, artists who settled there might say in the end it is becoming too popular. So it is not just west of Tokyo like Koenji, which we describe then is a kind of in a kind of a comparison. And I think the last two cases, Ichigaya and Kiyosumi Shirakawa, are also showing that actually whatever place you choose, you could find some social environmental factors, soft factors, which show the kind of creativity. And Ichigaya is really the edge of, as we know it, Yamanote Shitamachi areas, very central, near the old palace of the emperor. And it is a kind of combination of traditional craftsmanship, artisan, and then new elements as rooftop gardens and urban gardening and creatives which start shared offices and just exchange their ideas. And Kiyosumi Shirakawa being really, I would say near Monze Nakacho, near Sumidagawa, being these old areas where not so much, let's say, culture was flourishing, but it has still rich history. And nowadays, this Koto ward has also realized that they have a lot of potential, potentially spaces, potentially, inhabitants coming to that area. So they really have supported in their unique way, I have to say, the kind of, settlement of young artists. And that's not just since the last 5 or 10 years, but 20 years ago. So old factories were used by galleries and so on. But even nowadays, it has such a unique scene of, let's say, artists and even a winery where you say wine produced in Tokyo. So it's still flourishing. And that's a fascinating thing. You can't just say, oh, it is a rundown area.
Yeah, it's I don't have a lot to add to what Heidi, because Heidi really explained in detail our cases. Maybe I can say just this, that our cases were quite interestingly forged together, because not only we paid attention to the locality of a specific case study that was used and explained within the book, but we also used a lot of focus to identify the actors. So within the interviews that were done in specific neighborhoods, in specific parts of Tokyo, we also paid the attention to various groups which were included in these case studies. So we paid attention not only to, to people which work in specific parts of the creative sector, but we paid attention actually to this social creativity, which Heidi already explained. So we tried to identify various types of creativity and try to identify to get enough information from various type of players within these neighborhoods that share their and get their view, their perception, their angle of story that they want to talk to us. And we try to integrate all these perspectives and represent them in such a way that you can possibly sense the distinctions between specific actors that all together in a holistic way combine the creative X system from bottom up, not just from top down. So the primary intention was to go to these smaller areas, to these local neighborhoods, and then climb our way up to the more core areas and to more core groups, which represent, the top of the pyramid.
Go ahead. Maybe to just give the reader a bit of snapshot, if you don't mind. Of course, not everybody has the book in front of them. But if you go to page 180, there is a very interesting aspect. For example, just a very short piece. Walking along a shotengai, a shopping street, and turning left into a narrow alleyway, we come across a handmade leatherback manufacturer with a French name. We see no boxes or bicycles parked along the walls, and the space is kept clean so that customers can enter the shop easily. Inside the shop, the transition from Japan to the deepest part of Paris is obvious, as Alata-san learned his craft in Paris and returned to Tokyo in 2012. So just, giving people that hybrid, hyper-modern, hyper-traditional perspective.
I think it's just amazing how much one can notice with an observing eye. And I think next time, if I have a chance to go to Tokyo, I would definitely try and look for these little things that demonstrate their creativity. So out of all these neighborhoods that you discuss and you walk through in Tokyo, if you have to choose a favorite one, which one would it be and why?
Oh, that's a, I mean, this is a, that's a very difficult question. It's the same with picking your favorite food or picking, you know, but as a Tokyo, or not, I mean, not living in the central area anymore, when I arrived, maybe just going back to the very first, you know, longer period of fieldwork, I was living in Yanaka, which was at that time fascinating, not just for me, but for many other people beforehand. Yanaka. But moving, you know, on 15 years later, or how many years later, I would say it is, I think the combination of tradition and modernity kind of coexisting in, I don't want to say peaceful, but in a not harming way. And I really, when living in then Kotoku and nearby Kyushu-Mashikara, I was, I think, maybe most fascinated if there is room for development. So it's not so much already, like we say, globalized or localized or, you know, commodified. But if there is still this kind of flexibility that people can come and realize something new, and they don't have to fit in specific rigid groups or structures. And I think wherever that is, whether that is in, you know, Kotoku or in Sumidaku or even outside Tokyo, I think a community should feel like that common, you know, that urban common, that commoning, then we share something together and don't just become an elite like maybe Harajuku or Shimokitazawa or others. So these cute little neighborhoods which keep their identity. I think that's very important. So,
well, in my case, I'm quite perplexed. I mean, I'm an let's say I'm standing in two with one foot. I really like the central area, the central areas, the core areas, because I like the liveliness, the density. I got to admit, I adore it. I mean, because it's so, the vibrancy is incredible. And on the other side, the other food is also in the local neighborhood. And I really liked all these cases that we mentioned, going from Shirakawa to Hikifune, and I like all these cases. So I can say that I'm really ambiguous, and it's difficult for me to answer this question because it's like asking which is my favorite movie. It's so difficult. It's impossible to answer it. And I guess I would say that that my opinion changes with my age, that the older that I'm getting, more I like maybe the local areas and less I like the core areas. But I'm still a true fan of let's say also of the global imprint of Tokyo.
That's thank you. That's, I mean, there it has to be a difficult choice only because all these areas are equally interesting in their own unique ways, just as you pictured in your book, that it's impossible to pick a favorite, right? I think that's like one of the attractive features of these places.
Yes, and even moving on, that now we have completed that book, and that might have been not the last, that we say even other cities, including Sapporo, Hokkaido, Osaka and Kansai or whatever, have so many things to offer. So if we have a chance to live there or experience that or do some fieldwork there, that I think, yes, Tokyo being, I don't want to say overrepresented, and, you know, we also have done that book about Tokyo, but this is our first contribution to it. But if other scholars, or even, you know, including us, have the chance to cover other areas, other local places, then I think it's fascinating to just continue addressing that questions and see how it's changing.
That's awesome. Now, as we move towards the end of this conversation, I want to just ask one last question. In the clash between the changing economic environment brought by globalization and the efforts of local creative actors to preserve and revitalize everyday life, what kind of future do you picture for places in Tokyo as well as other parts of the world that share similar issues with Tokyo? And why do you think so?
It is a... It is a, let's say that in sociology, we are, I can say that this question didn't go unnoticed and that it is present quite for a long time. And basically, for example, I will use the David Howe's words about this. Because what he says, he said that there are two options. In one option is that that the place becomes engulfed with the sameness, with same things, that you got this, that same elements just engulf all the other elements around the world, that you have the same high streets, that you have an Omotesando or some other area, I would say, that you have this high classical consumption areas and so on. And so one scenario is this. And the other, the second scenario, which is also very possible, is that because of this presence of this constant influx of the same elements, that the elements which make a space, or I better use the word place, that make a place special, will become even more important. So that the sensitiveness for these differences in space will increase. So that that these things which makes places different from each other will become even more noticed. So I guess both scenarios are going on the same trait at once. And we're going to see which way it will go. But I'm not so pessimistic because I can see that I can see cases around the world when I travel for work and so on, that some places, some cities, some urban areas have become really attentive of what they produce in space and how they produce a space. And they produce it not just physically, but also socially. So they have become really attentive about social production of space. On the other hand, of course, you have places, or better say that places became spaces because they became less attentive about what they put in space. And they just want to increase the economic potential of that area. So both scenarios are possible, but I can sense that Tokyo has a good chance in this regard to make a step in the optimist in the direction of the optimist scenario. So I'm quite optimistic about the thing.
Yeah, I think, you know, every city, of course, struggles with, you know, elderly or shrinking or, you know, other aspects, of course, especially after the last year, which was, you know, having a huge impact on, you know, not just countries, but especially cities. So I think, yes, some areas, you might say, they become the same, they, you know, they look the same. And there's a danger of just taking the example of Harajuku Station, where they turned down or even pulled down that historical building. So why not finding a combination? We just have been in Yamanashi City over the weekend, and you know, there they combined the historical building with a new building. So I guess you can't just generalize and say Japan is you know, basically erasing the history and just focusing on modernity, as you might see it in other countries. I think it always depends on the perspective. It depends on the case. And if you have the knowledge, you have to share that experience with others to show that there is always a, you know, a choice you have. I mean, it's not like, you know, we just have one approach to urban planning and we have to globalize, because as the title indicates, maturity eventually has to ask, is asking about the quality of life. People will keep on doing their best or participating when we talk about place making or participating in, you know, actively into urban planning or machizukuri, as it's called in Japanese. Then you have to also ask, so what are you offering, not just promising, but offering people in return? And quality of life, or let's say, why would it be worthwhile living in either Tokyo or local areas? I mean, at the moment, there's a trend of, you know, going to the local areas and just also exploring that things. But it will be always this kind of urban rural linkage or that transnational description where people move in between spaces. So it is always the influence from the outsider and the insider. So I think I'm not always, sharing perspectives of, let's say, many economics or economic approaches where it's negative and saying, oh, we need to worry about such and such. So I think whatever people need and whatever politicians are doing there, and of course, nobody is perfect, so they also make mistakes, and let's hope they learn from them.
Thank you. I really appreciate the broader implications of your study, how it extends to things that we should not forget as we try to grow more and more and more in economy, and not forget where we came from and what we produce. I think a lot of places, including my hometown, actually should really see the long-term impact of what they're doing to the city. And well, thank you so much, Dr. Imai and Dr. Yusuk, for such a wonderful conversation. And thank you, everybody. Yes, thank you. Thank you. And thanks, everybody, for joining us in the New Books on Japanese Studies channel. If you want to learn more about urban creativity of Tokyo, of Japan, check out this book, Creativity in Tokyo, Revitalizing a Mature City. Stay tuned for our next episode. And until then, goodbye.